From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Having written a good deal on people who have developed theories about grand conspiracies, John Ronson is often confused with the theorists themselves. It's because he gets caught up in the stories he tells, develops, if not an affection for, at least a real relationship with these people. Ronson contributes stories to the public radio program This American Life, and in one of these pieces he says he's been accused of suffering from the great liberal misimpression that basically everyone is good underneath.
I'd argue instead that most people are a mix of good and bad, and that to see ourselves in them is better than seeing them as inhuman, as something that is impossible to recognize.
Today in the program, John Ronson is with us to talk about the book he wrote on conspiracy theory. It's called Them, Adventures with Extremists. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Many of us here in the United States first came to hear the compelling and funny writing of John Ronson on the public radio program This American Life. Many of his stories tell about his relationships with people who have a more complicated view of the world than most. These people have grand theories about secret cabals of the elite gathering somewhere in a secret room to map out the world economy and control information. Ronson never seems to stay at arm's length from his subjects, though. He gets to know them and he notices stuff about them, the minute details of their lives, the things on the walls in their houses, the way they speak. And he particularly picks up on those moments of silence in conversation, which always seem to say a lot. Some of you may remember John's story about Omar Bakri Mohammed, the Islamic extremist in London, which he profiled in a piece for This American Life called My Friend the Extremist.
I first met Omar Bakri Mohammed shortly after he declared holy war on Britain in 1995. There were maybe 5,000 of Omar Bakri's followers in Trafalgar Square when he announced that he wouldn't rest until he saw the black flag of Islam flying over Downing Street and the White House. There was much cheering. The stage had been rented out to him by the local city council, from which he outlined his post-jihad vision for the UK. He who practiced homosexuality, adultery, fornication or bestiality would be stoned to death or thrown from the highest mountain. Christmas decorations and shop window dummies would be outlawed. Pubs would be closed down. Pictures of ladies' legs on packets of pantyhose would be banned. We'd still be able to buy pantyhose, but they'd be advertised simply with the word pantyhose.
Well, today on the program, John Ronson is with us to talk about what he's learned over the years, covering people with, different theories on conspiracy. His book, one particular book, is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. John Ronson is a journalist, a documentary filmmaker, a BBC radio host, and, as we said, a regular contributor to This American Life, also the program All Things Considered. His first book is Them, Adventures with Extremists, and his most recent book is The Men Who Stare at Goats. John Ronson is joining us today by phone from his home in London. And John Ronson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for wanting to have me.
I want to ask, first of all, John, when did you first start thinking about, about the theories, about the different ideas that people had, about there being these little secret elite having these? I mean, when did this first strike you? Have you always thought about it?
No, not at all. It was, in fact, when I started hanging out with Omar Bakri Mohammed. And that was back in 96, 11 years ago. And it was his people who first started saying to me, did you know that there was a shadowy cabal secretly ruling the world from inside a secret room, and they meet once a year and they start the wars and decide who's going to be the next president or prime minister. And I really didn't think much about it at all. I thought it was just a kind of slightly boring thing that they said amidst all the more interesting things. But then about a year later, I was hanging out with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan in Arkansas. And they said exactly the same thing. They said, did you know that there was a shadowy cabal? And both the Klan and the militant Islamists had the same name for this cabal. They both called it the Bilderberg Group. So I thought, how interesting that these two extremist factions that I didn't think would have anything in common both believed in this thing I'd never heard of called Bilderberg. And I guess that's what spurred my interest.
What do you think you wanted to find? Did you want to debunk it, or did you think there was something more to it than that?
To tell you the truth, I thought I was going to go on a funny kind of... I apologize. My wife downstairs is trying to get on this line.
That's okay.
I figured that we're doing a live interview and eventually give up and use her cell phone.
Okay.
I think what interested me actually right at the beginning was a kind of narrative. I thought this would be a really interesting, funny, shaggy dog story.
Yeah.
I'll take these conspiracists at their word and try and track down this group that I know doesn't exist, but maybe we'll have some kind of funny scrapes along the way, and perhaps these funny scrapes will shed some light on the relationship between their world and our world.
Mm.
So I saw it as a kind of narrative device, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah.
But then, within about 3 weeks, I was getting chased by men in dark glasses, so it stopped being a narrative device. It started being a really frightening thing.
You know, you say in your book that, you know, a lot of the motivation for people who write about conspiracy theorists is to, you know, find hypocrisy, to kind of humiliate or, you know, disgrace some of the people. But it doesn't seem like you're the way you develop a kind of relationship with them, and then the way you write about them, there's a kind of affection. It's more complicated, I guess, for you.
Well, I kind of think so. I mean, I've always been against finger pointing and setting myself, you know, because I'm a kind of, you know, urban sophisticate. Not that I'm that sophisticated, but I live in London. I live in kind of mainstream society. I've always been really opposed to people like me hanging out with people like them, but with an air of superiority, you know, with a kind of liberal arched eyebrow. It always kind of annoys me. It seems so smug. And you know, I kind of like people, and it's my instinct is to find good in people, is to try and connect to people, even if they're people who, you know, sort of, you know, hate me because I'm Jewish and urban and liberal. So I'm kind of the enemy to them. But nonetheless, I thought, well, it's not so much that I thought I wanted to sort of find their human qualities. It's just automatically what I look for. I try and connect to people on a human level.
Yeah.
I used to say, actually, that we quite often connected on a kind of neurotic level. We were both, you know, me and the extremists share a kind of neurosis. And the irony is that my neurosis comes from being Jewish, whereas their neurosis often manifests itself in a kind of blind hatred of Jews. But nonetheless, it's a kind of hands across the ocean sort of connection that we had. We both got paranoid easily.
Right. I want to play another section from your piece on This American Life, which I think... that piece on Omar Mohammed Bakri, where, because it reveals this kind of interplay between you and your subjects. And I think in a lot of ways it sort of helps us understand the characters better. So let me play this section again. Here's John Ronson again from a story he produced for This American Life, again called My Friend the Extremist.
Omar's plan for the morning was to hand out leaflets entitled Homosexuality, Lesbianism, Adultery, Fornication and Bestiality, The Deadly Diseases. He said he couldn't help notice my car in the driveway, so perhaps I would give him a lift. OK, I said. I dropped him off near the tube station. I went to park the car. 10 minutes later, I found him standing in the middle of the pavement with a stack of leaflets in his hand. How's it going, Omar? I asked. Oh, very good, he smiled. The message is getting across that there are some deadly diseases here and there. He turned to the passers-by. Homosexuality, he yelled. Beware the deadly disease. Beware the hour. Some time passed. Homosexuality, yelled Omar. Beware. There are homosexuals everywhere. I expected to see some hostility to Omar's leaflets from the passers-by. But the shoppers and tourists and office workers seemed to regard him with a kindly bemusement. Nonetheless, after 10 minutes, nobody had actually taken a leaflet. Beware the hour, there are homosexuals everywhere. Beware the hour, continued Omar cheerfully. Be careful from homosexuality. It is not good for your tummy. Omar Bakri was unlike my image of a Muslim extremist. Then he told me he had a good idea. Just watch this, he said. He turned the leaflets upside down. Help the orphans, he yelled. Help the orphans. Omar, I exclaimed, scandalised. The passers-by started to accept the leaflets. This is good, chuckled Omar. This is good, you see. If I wasn't a Muslim, I'd be working for, how you say, Saatchi and Saatchi.
I wonder if hearing those, it takes you back to those earlier times when you first came to know him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that really struck me listening back to that was the fact that all the passers-by regarded Omar with a kindly bemusement. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's gone in the past few years. Nobody looks at Omar kindly anymore. And I think that kind of, you know, obviously one of the things that died on 9/11 was the British tradition, a kind of glorious British tradition of accepting and respecting political radicals, and you know that's another thing that died on 9/11. Mm. Also, listening back to that, I remarked I always do on just how fantastically assiduous the production of This American Life is. They probably put weeks into getting the music and my words mixed as beautifully as that.
Yeah, it's a great show. Well,
and go on. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that. What do you think it is, sort of at the heart of a conspiracy? Is it that people don't have a sense of the world? They don't really understand it. I mean, you could say on one hand it's just suspicion and hate and ignorance. But how do you see it?
Well, I think there's a number of things going on with conspiracy theorists. One is that, you know, there are conspiracies in the world, and the more nefariously our leaders behave, the more conspiracy theories flourish. So, for instance, you know, if we go to war in Iraq on shaky grounds, you're going to get a big renaissance of conspiracy theories, which, as you can see, has happened. You know, the two things don't, you know, the way our if our leaders start behaving conspiratorially, you're going to get conspiracy theories. So that's number one. I don't want to sort of put all the blame on the conspiracy theorists. But nonetheless, I see conspiracy theorists. I've certainly grown to see conspiracy theorists as being a kind of bad in the world, because it just drives me nuts. That because, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theorists and so on can be so aggressive and so pompous, and it sort of saddens me that so many people are spending their lives believing in something that isn't true, which is that, you know, holograms flew into the World Trade Center, or, you know, the bus in Tavistock Square in London on July the 7th wasn't a real bus, and it wasn't real victims, it was actors. I mean, these kind of, you know, nonsense and I'd say offensive theories. And so it's upsetting that, you know, a lot of radicals who usually would be skeptical in a good way are now being skeptical in a ridiculous way, wasting their lives believing this nonsense. But I think there's many other reasons why conspiracy theorists are conspiracy theorists. I mean, I think we all love, you know, Agatha Christie, you know, amateur sleuth type things. We all like to look at the skies and try and see clues. You know, so I think, you know, I met a young conspiracy theorist last night. I was giving a talk at the Edinburgh Festival, and this guy came up to me and said, you know, don't be too hard on conspiracy theorists because, you know, skepticism is good, not believing the official line is good. And of course, that's absolutely true. But, you know, what I've come to really object to is people just believing in things that aren't true.
There's a section in a piece in the London Times, Caitlin Moran wrote about you. She wrote this, that you write these things to reassure himself that behind every fringe element bent on world domination, there are people doing foolish things, being human. She writes, it's his way of coping with the awful, pitching terror of life.
Yeah. Caitlin, you know, I think she's right, you know, that, you know, because she was wondering why me, a slightly neurotic you know, fearful person would spend my life getting into really dangerous situations. It's like, you know, Woody Allen finding himself in the middle of the Manchurian Candidate or something. And why would I do that? And that was her analysis, that you know, if I go to the darkest places and find humanity, then it makes the world a less frightening place for me. Maybe that's going on somewhere in my subconscious. I'm not sure. I mean, I just like a kind of cracking story. I like to have adventures. If I spend too much time, you know, in my room. I could never be a novelist, because if I spend too much time in my room, you know, I turn into Caspar Hauser, you know, that kind of wolf child howls at the moon. So I just like getting out and having adventures. But it did surprise me, and continues to surprise me, just how central conspiracy theories are to the practice of terrorism in the world. You know, show me a terrorist, you know, show me a murderer, a politically motivated murderer, and I'll show you a conspiracy theorist.
John Ronson is with us. He is a journalist, a documentary filmmaker, a regular contributor to This American Life. He's the author of the book Them, Adventures with Extremists. We invite you to join us, by the way, if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90 and XM Public Radio.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then your cigarette.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the theories of conspiracy theorists, sort of, anyway. We're getting a unique take on the subject from the British journalist and documentary filmmaker John Ronson. Like all of us, Ronson had heard the stories that there was a group that secretly ruled the world, a shadowy elite that met in a secret room somewhere to plan global affairs and control the media. So a few years ago, he set out to settle the matter for himself. He didn't, by the way. His book is kind of dark, really funny. It's called Them, Adventures with Extremists. Today on the program, John Ronson is with us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. John Ronson, I want to ask you about, you mentioned going to visit people of the Ku Klux Klan a few years ago, and you came across a really interesting character, Tom Road. What was it about Tom Road that you found really interesting?
Yeah, well, he was a Klan leader who decided that the future of, this is around the time that if you wanted to be a successful Klan, you had to get on the Jerry Springer show. That was the way to recruit new members, was to get yourself on, you know, Montel or Jerry Springer, one of these big shows. And Tom had this unique idea, which was to give the Klan an image makeover. He would create a politically correct Ku Klux Klan. So he got all his members together and told them that they were no longer allowed to wear the robes and the hoods. They couldn't have any more cross burnings. They weren't allowed to use the N-word, as Tom always called it. They weren't allowed to hate people anymore. And obviously, as Klansmen, you know, you kind of thought, well, these are all the things that were kind of fun about being in the Klan. That's like, what's left? Yeah. You know, we kind of joined the Klan because we wanted to hate people. And Tom said, no, you can't do that anymore. And instead, he kind of erected a marquee in his garden. And all his Klansmen had to sit in the marquee and fill out these sort of, you know, these personality tests like the Scientologists do, you know, these kind of multiple choice, which of the following words most applies to you, you know, the following strengths and weaknesses, like mixes easily and so on. So I just thought it was a sort of fabulous look at just the inroads to which political correctness, you know, had reached in America, that all the way out in the sort of Arkansas Ozarks, the Klan were now being politically correct. I just thought that was really funny. Yeah. And it was really interesting to see how the Western world dealt with a new politically correct Klan.
There's this kind of touching moment in that story with Tom Road. And you're in the car together and you're going to a gathering, and some of the other people in the car are asleep, and then there's this kind of intimate moment where he turns to you and he asks you if you think he's weird.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I loved that bit, actually. He said, "Do you think I'm weird?"
Yeah.
And there was a silence, and I said, "Well, I think you're in a transitional phase between weird and not weird." And he said, "Well, you know, how do I know if I'm weird or not? You know, I just hang out with Glansmen all the time. You know, we're all weird. You know." And I noticed that with Tom Robb quite a lot, that he would always, you know, he seemed to like me a lot more than his members. Huh. It's kind of nevershy Jewish journalist from London. He liked me more than he liked, you know, his Glansmen. You know, he allowed them to have one cross lighting a year. They call it cross lighting, not cross burning.
Yeah.
He lets them have one of them a year. And because they're so rusty, they couldn't remember whether to soak it in kerosene and then raise it, or raise it first and then soak it in kerosene. So they were like having a big argument about this, and Tom came over and he said, "Tom, do we soak it and then raise it, or raise it and then soak it?" And he said, "You soak it and then raise it. How are you gonna soak it after you've raised it?" And then he looked at me and he gave me a look that unmistakably said, "John, I'm sorry that my members are such idiots." And I was thinking, this, you know, Tom, you know, this isn't great leadership skills you're showing here. That, you know, you're kind of belittling all your fans to this visiting journalist.
You know, it seems like in all of your stories, no, in a lot of your stories, certainly in this one, there are these moments where we really like these characters. You know, we think, oh, they're just sort of, they're disturbing maybe what they think, but, you know, they're benign enough. But there's this moment, but you also reveal these moments that are a little bit darker. And there's this other moment with Tom where he doesn't know that you're listening, and he's talking about having been interviewed by this Asian American journalist.
People always send, you know, whenever the Klan's interviewed, they always send either black people or Asians because they want to get a rise out of the Klan.
Yeah.
So no wonder, you know, Tom thinks that you know, the American media is overrun with minorities. The only journalist he ever meets are black or Jewish or Asian for that reason. But yeah, and he called her a high yellow, which seemed like that's a very weird choice of phrase, isn't it? A high yellow. I mean, that's somebody who thinks a lot about racism. And then he saw me and looked guilty. Nonetheless, you know what the first prize in the Klan raffle was when I attended? Walter Matthau videos. So, even out in the Ozarks, I didn't feel quite so alone. We were doing all right. We had Walter Matthau. I had Walter Matthau there to support me.
There's always a surreal moment or two in your stories where there's this silence. You refer to that. You often see written, "Then there was silence." Sort of an awkward silence.
It's a phrase I use a lot. Yeah. In fact, I probably overuse it a bit. But I do love the silences, because in the silence, you know, I or somebody else knows they've been found out, or we're about to have to lie and spin our way further, you know, into more lies. You know, in that silence, a lot of embarrassing and bad things can happen. And I love my silences. I guess it's something I learned from reading people like Raymond Carver and Tobias Wolff and Kurt Vonnegut, you know, three sort of maestros of leaving things unsaid.
Yeah. You say you really only worked out how to write with this book, Them, Adventures with Extremists.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've been writing professionally for sort of more than 20 years. I'm 40 now, and I've been writing, you know, for a living since I was about 18 or 19. But I think until I wrote Them, I was a bit of a plagiarist. You know, I like all young journalists, I was plagiarizing, you know, PJ O'Rourke and Hunter S. Thompson. And it was actually, you know, plagiarizing Hunter S. Thompson was kind of weird because I wasn't a kind of, you know, drugged out tough, you know, hippie. So it was kind of weird that I'd adopt that stance. And you know, my writing had a kind of streak of cruelty in it back then as well.
Huh.
But that wasn't me. And yeah, and I think when I sat down and wrote Them, and I think it all the subsequent stuff, I've just quit actually, but for the last 3 years, I've been writing a weekly column about my domestic life for the London Guardian, trying to show how people in their family lives can be just as crazy, can get themselves in just as crazy irrational bubbles as the extremists. And, you know, now I really feel as if I found my voice with them and with the subsequent writing. Mm. Now I love it.
I want to get back to that that secret room that you were intrigued by, the Bilderberg meetings. When did you first start? When you first started hearing about them, it seems to me that you figured that in a day, you know, in a digital age where information was everywhere, that you should be able to find something out about it. You should be able to discover whether or not this was real.
There was virtually nothing about them. The only people at this time talking about Bilderberg were crazy people, you know, were extremists and conspiracy theorists and neo-Nazis and, you know, militia guys. You know, nobody in the mainstream press ever mentioned the Bilderberg group. So I thought, well, you know, what happened actually after the Klan and the militant Islamists told me about Bilderberg, I started asking questions, and they said, well, there's one guy who knows more about this group, the Bilderberg group, than anyone in the world, and his name is Big Jim Tucker, and he lives in Washington, D.C., and he spent his life trying to track down Bilderberg. And actually, I think the Bilderberg conspiracy theories are kind of unique in that they can be pretty much traced back to this one man, Jim Tucker. You know, he's a guy who kind of first identified them and has been chasing them ever since. So I phoned up Jim Tucker and I said, you know, is this true? Does this group exist? And he said, yep. He said, they always meet once a year in a 5-star hotel with golfing facilities, and that's where they rule the world. And they start the wars and they elect the heads of state, and you know, they do every evil you can imagine. And he said, you've caught me at a good time. I've discovered through my mole that the Bilderberg group are meeting at the end of May, beginning of June, at the Caesar Park Hotel and Golfing Resort in Sintra, Portugal. And he said, I'm going to fly over there, climb up the drain pipes, get in and confront them red-handed going about their covert wickedness. So I said, can I come? And Tim said, you know, yes, you can, as long as you don't step on twigs when we're on the prowl.
Right.
So Jim and I flew to Portugal, and I got into hot water.
Well, I wanted you to read a section from the book, because it's really funny
and frightening. I know which section you want me to read, because Jennifer, your producer, emailed it to me.
Yes.
And I have it right here in front of me. What happened with me and Jim, you know, I really didn't think this group existed, but I kind of figured I'll go along for the ride because it sounds like fun. And so we flew to Portugal the day before the Bilderberg group was supposed to arrive, and scouted around the hotel, trying to forge contacts with waitresses, which we weren't very good at, I've got to say. Jim's like a 60-year-old sort of southern gentleman in a straw trilby, really like something out of, you know, Sam Spade. And then we left the hotel and got into our car, and the section I'm going to read from my book, Them, is what happened when we got into the car. This is my telephone call to the British Embassy. I'm a journalist from London, I said. I'm calling you on the road from Sintra to Estoril. I'm being tailed right now by a dark green Lancia belonging to the Bilderberg group. There was a sharp intake of breath. Go on, she said. I'm sorry, I said, but I just heard you take a sharp breath. She said, she went, go on, like that. Bilderberg, she said. Yes, I said. They watched us scouting around the Caesar Park Hotel, and they've been following us ever since. We have now been followed for 3 hours. I wasn't sure at first, so I stopped my car on the side of a deserted lane, and he stopped his car right in front of us. Can you imagine just how chilling that moment was? This is especially disconcerting because I'm from England and I'm not used to being spied on. Do you have Bilderberg's permission to be in Portugal? She said. Do they know you're here? No, I said. Bilderberg are very secretive, she said. They don't want people looking into their business. What are you doing here? I am essentially a humorous journalist, I explained. I am a humorous journalist out of my depth. Do you think it might help if we tell them that? From the corner of my eye, I saw Jim wind down his window. He leant his head out and blew an antagonizing, ladylike kiss at the Lancia. Hold on a second, I said. Jim, I said sternly, please stop that. I lowered my voice. I'm here with an American, I said, called Big Jim Tucker. He's an agent provocateur. That might be the problem. Perhaps you can phone Bilderberg and explain that I may be in the car with Jim Tucker, but I'm not actually with him. Listen, she said urgently. Bilderberg is much bigger than we are. We're very small. We're just a little embassy. Do you understand? They're way out of our league. All I can say is go back to your hotel and sit tight. That's the end of the passage. As I say, when I got back to the hotel, she phoned me back, the woman for the British Embassy, and said she'd spoken to the Bilderberg office, and they said that nobody was following us. And how could they call off someone who didn't exist?
Right.
To which I said, he's behind the tree. To which she said, and this is the moment that stays with me more than any other. She said, well, the good news is that you know you're being followed. The dangerous ones would be those you don't know are following you. Which I kind of thought was scant comfort, because what if these ones were the dangerous ones? I just happened to be naturally good at spotting them. What if, you know, an average, yeah, I just happen to sort of, you know, when I'm being chased by men in dark glasses, I spot them.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but this is the thing, though. I mean, in your stories, you don't ever debunk it. I mean, in this particular story, we're always left thinking, you know, I've never really believed in the Bilderberg, but all of a sudden, I do.
Yeah,
in some weird way.
And you know, I it was certainly the moment any sort of vestige of sort of urban superiority, you know, just vanished, and I became the people I've been chronicling for the last few years. You know, I became really paranoid, and the paranoia really stuck with me. I mean, when I got back to London, I phoned my wife actually as I was being chased, and I said, you know, Elaine, I'm really out of my depth here. I'm being followed by, you know, these men in dark glasses, and I may never see you again, and, you know, I'm very scared. And Elaine said, oh, you're loving it. It's only when I got home and showed her the footage, because I started filming the chase, did she think, oh, my God, you know, that was kind of frightening.
Tell the story, if you would, of the ritual in the Bohemian Grove in Northern California. It's another adventure, which is hysterical from your book, Them.
Actually, probably the most bizarre adventure I've ever had. I started hearing that not only does the Bilderberg Group exist, but many of the same people who go to Bilderberg, people like David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger and Dick Cheney and George Bush Sr., also attend this secret summer camp in the forests of Northern California called Bohemian Grove. And it's like a 3-week summer camp where they all sleep in luxury tents. And then on the middle Saturday night, they all drift down to this pond and they put on robes and have a ritual that culminates in a human effigy being thrown into the fiery belly of a 50-foot stone owl. So I thought, that can't be true. So I've got to sneak in there and have a look and see what's going on. So I did. I phoned up a few of my conspiracy theorist pals, and I said, you know, do you fancy coming into Bohemian Grove with me? And this guy from Texas, a Texan conspiracy talk show host called Alex Jones, said, I'll come. I'll smuggle a camera in and get right in their satanic devil-worshipping faces, and we'll blow this thing wide open. And I said, I think stealth might be a better approach. And Alex said, okay, stealth.
Yeah.
So we flew to Northern California, and we had a kind of ill-thought-out plan that we would rent a boat and kind of climb up the mountain and shimmy down the other side of the mountain and get in that way. And then we met this local lawyer called Rick, who had himself successfully infiltrated Bohemian Grove, we'd heard. And we met him, and we told him our plan. And he said, no, you know, this is really dangerous terrain. This is a sheer rock face. He said, if you go in that way, you're going to get yourself killed. But I always remember with Alex, Alex Jones got out his notepad and wrote, going in that way, -killed. So we said, well, how do we get in? And he said, easy, you just go to the local preppy clothes shop, go to, you know, Eddie Bauer or somewhere, and buy yourself preppy clothes, like, you know, chinos and so on, cashmere. And just walk up the drive. Just walk up the drive and give the security guard a kind of I rule the world wave. And you'll be fine. You can get in that way. So that's what we did. And it was incredible.
Incredible. It really was.
Well, I should say, Alex and Mike, his producer, at the last minute decided to go in alone.
Yeah.
And they went in via the undergrowth and got terribly stung by poison ivy. And I walked up the drive with Rick, the lawyer. And we got in, and I found myself in the middle of this extraordinary luxury encampment with a lot of sort of devilish, a kind of devilish milieu, you know, like a kind of architect, you know, like an interior designer would come in to make the whole thing look a bit like the Rocky Horror Show, with sort of little red lanterns everywhere in the trees and these clusters of tents with grand pianos and jacuzzis. And in the middle was this giant, at the time I thought it was a giant stone owl, but I've since learned actually that it was a fiberglass owl. It's like a kind of model, almost like a stage setting. And at 9 o'clock, this bell rang, and these 1,000 men, all of whom looked like Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, drifted down to this grass near the owl. And this ritual began, which was hilarious, you know, but not, I mean, they took it massively seriously, all the bohemians, and I subsequently discovered that Dick Cheney and George Bush Sr. were there the same time I was there, because they actually said in the newspaper, this was 2000, was it 2000? What year was President Bush first elected? 2000?
Yeah. Yes,
so
2000.
It must be 99, because when Bush announced that Dick Cheney was to be his running mate, Bush Sr. was at Bohemian Grove. It was announced in the paper, and that was when we were there. And, so they all drifted down, and these men in robes and hoods. Well, it began, actually, with a kind of guy wearing lederhosen, leaf-covered lederhosen, lederhosen covered in leaves and twigs, appears in the forest. And, by the way, Alex taped this whole ceremony on his camera. So anybody listening could go onto the internet now and put in, I don't know, John Ronson, Bohemian Grove, or Bohemian Grove, Alex Jones footage or something, and you'll see this footage because it's out there now. So this guy with lederhosen came on and started eulogizing nature, and then all these men in robes and hoods turned up and started saying, you know, oh, we shall burn thee once again this night. And then you hear the voice of the human effigy going, ye shall not burn me, like kind of echoing through the trees. And then this kind of papier-mâché figure turns up on a gondola in the lake. And the berobed men lift it up and throw us in this giant bonfire in front of the giant owl. And then they all sing When the Saints Go Marching In. And then they all stand up and start partying again. So really, you know, the ritual happens. It was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen in my life. and anyone can see it because it's right there on the internet.
Well, and you can read about it in John Ronson's book called Them, Adventures
That's
with
Extremists. That's a
better
idea.
Yeah, it's a better idea, isn't it? Them, Adventures with Extremists is his book. John's joining us from London. We invite you to join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, or send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90 and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Ronson, the British filmmaker, documentary filmmaker and writer, is with us today talking about his book, Them, Adventures with Extremists. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, or our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. John Ronson, in your latest piece for This American Life, you introduce us to Rachel North, who was one of the dozens of people injured in the train bombings in London on July 7th. How did you find her, and what were you getting at in that story? What were you trying to learn, I guess?
Well, I'll tell you how I first found her. I made the mistake of accidentally typing my name into Google, pressing search one day when I should have been writing, but instead I decided to see what people were writing about me. And I found this thread on the internet by all these 9/11 conspiracy theorists and July 7th conspiracy theorist. That was the day of the London bombs.
Yeah.
Basically saying I was, part of the conspiracy to spread, lies about 9/11, and the real truth will come out one day. I was either shill or I was stupid. All this kind of nasty stuff by conspiracy theorists. Mm. And somebody wrote, "He's another Rachel North." And I thought, how odd. I'm another who? Who's this woman, Rachel North? And then I forgot about it. And then I got an email from this woman, actually, who said, "I'm Rachel North, and I see you've been incurring the wrath of the conspiracy theorists." And so I got to know her, and I've become, I think, good friends with Rachel. And basically, she worked in advertising, and she got on the train one day, July the 7th, really crammed carriage. And then the carriage exploded, and 26 people were killed on the train. And she survived relatively uninjured, and became a spokesperson for the survivors of that particular train bombing. Mm. King's Cross United was the name of the group. And she looked herself up on Google, and discovered that all these conspiracy theorists were claiming that she didn't exist and that she was actually a team of MI5 intelligence officers spreading lies, about July 7th. And so she tried to engage with them and explain that she did exist, and the more she tried to convince them that she existed, the more they became convinced that she didn't exist. So she found herself kind of in the middle of a David Lynch film.
Mm. I actually want to play a clip from the piece, because it seems like that was the kind of turning point for Rachel, is when she did decide she's going to, as opposed to ignore it, actually engage them. Let me play another clip. This is from John Ronson's piece that was on This American Life this last week. What part of bomb don't you understand?
And you started engaging with them a lot.
I was furious with them. I just thought, oh, they don't realise. As soon as they actually talk to a real person, they'll realise it's a load of nonsense, and they'll give up. It's just, I had no idea at all then about what these people were like. But what comes through again and again is this lack of empathy, complete lack of empathy. So they would, for example, cut and paste these the most harrowing descriptions by emergency services officers of going into carriages and seeing buckled walls that were streaming with blood and pieces of human flesh, and stepping over body parts and stepping over the hole where the bomb had torn a crater in the floor. They'd post this, and you couldn't read it without absolutely wanting to weep. And then they would say, that, you see, the hole there appears to be on the right-hand side. And that would be their comment.
They're just interested in the crater.
Yeah, just weird.
John Ronson, do you think that's something that you found, is a kind of this lack of empathy? Was that something that you found?
Yeah, and, I find it more difficult. I don't think I could write them now, because
wow.
I think conspiracy theories have become so prolific. So many people believe in them now, and they're getting nastier and nastier and more inhuman. And I know that a lot of your listeners will believe them and will be, sort of cursing me for saying this stuff now, because a huge number of people believe that 9/11 was an inside job and this and that. It's become almost like a kind of fundamentalist religion now, and it's become so nasty. I mean, I thought doing the piece with Rachel was so important because I guess I wanted to show that, the internet is getting nastier. People are getting more and more isolated from society and more unpleasant, I think, as a result, when they just sit at home and type away on message boards. And conspiracy theories are getting nastier. And there's an enormous lack of empathy, which... No, I'm not going to go to where I was going to say something. I was going to say, that the sort of that lack of empathy is something that the conspiracy theorists share with the people who commit these atrocities. Mm. But that's unfair. But because I do have a certain amount of respect for conspiracy theorists. I have a respect for free thinkers, for skeptics, for people who don't believe the official line. And so that side of conspiracy theorists, I admire. But the kind of fundamentalist, blinkered side of conspiracy theorists, when they just don't care about human life, they only care about the shape of the crater because they think it'll prove some point. You know, suddenly they're all structural engineers. They all know how the Twin Towers should fall, as if they really do know that.
You know,
just drives me nuts, you know, and I don't think it's funny anymore, and that's why I don't think I could write them.
Well, it seems like that this idea of sort of confronting it is important. In the earlier work, maybe confronting it in a maybe more gentle way, but I want to play another excerpt. It's a rather long excerpt from this story with Rachel North, where you do confront David Shaler. Say something about that.
Well, David Shaler is a very famous figure in the United Kingdom because he was an MI5 officer who I think he worked at MI5 for like 6 years. You know, MI5 is our version of the CIA, basically. And he then leaked MI5 secrets to a British newspaper and was imprisoned and was, you know, a bit of a hero, really, at that point. You know, he was imprisoned for freedom of speech. And then he came out of prison and became a conspiracy theorist and is now one of the leaders of the July 7th was an inside job and 9/11 was an inside job movement. And he and Rachel North met and had a huge fight. They all really shouted at each other, and I thought that I should go and meet. The original idea actually was for me and Rachel to go and meet David Shaler for the program, but Rachel was getting married, and so I did it alone. I went and met David Shaler alone to basically say to him, well, you know, how can you possibly think that Rachel North is a team of intelligence officers who doesn't exist when you've met her?
Let's play a section.
Well, I think you seem to think that the only reason why Rachel might be a group of men working for MI5 is because she doesn't want to sit down and engage with a conspiracy theorist.
No, I'm not. It's to do with her prestigious posting on the internet. And again, I think you should look at the evidence there about how many posts she was doing at one point.
She was posting a lot.
Because I think other people have looked at this in the movement and come to the opposite conclusion, that there were far too many posts to come from one person.
You know what bloggers are like. Just write and write and write.
Someday.
I don't understand why, because they're not getting paid.
I've crossed paths with the conspiracy theorists myself. I've spoken out against their irrational thoughts, and in retaliation they've set up a discussion thread called John Ronson, Shill or Stupid. A shill is a paid stooge. My experience with them is nothing compared to the abuse and the hate that Rachel incurred, but still, I've had terrible online fights with them. You're probably thinking it's nuts to engage with them, and you'd be right, it is nuts. It does nothing but bad. But when you're inside the bubble, sitting alone in your room staring at the internet, sometimes it's really hard to control yourself and do the sensible thing.
Do you regret jumping in and getting involved with them?
I think morally it was the right thing to do. I think from a personal point of view, I could do without the hate mail. I've had death threats. I could do without my, you know, I feel upset that my family were contacted.
When somebody who was actually there at the moment of the explosion, rather than somebody who sits at home on the internet and theorises, comes and confronts the theorists, why do the conspiracy theorists get so angry and so personal?
Well, I think, again, you're trying to make this to be the case, but I have to say, when Rachel North did come to one of our meetings, I thought her behaviour showed signs of mental illness.
Because Rachel was mentally ill?
I'm saying that the behaviour I saw over then, I don't know particularly well, showed signs of mental illness.
What did she do that was mentally ill?
It was the degree with which she attacked me for happening to say this thing about precisely the same stations. It was the fact that once she said it, she stood up, came running towards me and started shouting at me. There was a madness about this, and I would invite you to actually interview anybody else who was there, because they will say the same thing.
But that's because Rachel thinks it's nonsense.
How did she know until she's seen the evidence? And I say, I have the same problem. I'm getting the same sort of vibe off you here, John. You think it's nonsense. You haven't seen the evidence, you see.
But
this is the problem we're in, because
a
viewpoint arrived at without evidence is prejudice. And to say that Muslims carried out 9/11, those three guys from Leeds and one from Aylesbury, without evidence.
77, you mean?
Sorry, 77. The four guys. supposed to have carried out 7-7. The evidence is simply not there to say it. To say they did it.
What about the video? Was that
is racist, the... John? It's racist. You're being racist against Muslims if you think those three guys carried out that attack on the evidence there.
Oh, off. Do you? It's what I uncontrollably feel as if I should say to you, though, for so many reasons.
Can you include the recording of that in the actual interview, please? Because, or can I have a recording of that to play to people now? Because I don't think John here is actually being.
Well, you couldn't help yourself, I guess, John Watson.
No, I but I think in that response to David Shalo it's like the conclusion of 8 or 9 years of looking into conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists, and you know, after feeling very benign about it, you know, I don't feel so benign about it anymore. So I thought it was quite an important use of the F word in radio.
Do you think?
you know, David Shaler, I tell you what makes it slightly less of a proud moment for me, though, is that was recorded, I think, about 6 or 8 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And last week, David Shaler went on the British News to announce that he was the son of God. And so he's obviously had some kind of breakdown. And, you know, as a consequence, I mean, I couldn't tell at the time, and maybe it came on after the interview, but as a consequence, it doesn't seem quite as proud a moment for me.
Mm. You know, in the book, Them, Adventures with Extremists, there are those moments, you say, when you started feeling nostalgic for that time when you knew nothing. I've got about a minute left. Do you still feel that way? The fact that there are so few mysteries, as you say, left?
Well, actually, I think there are more mysteries. There are. I mean, my life is a kind of constant search for mystery. And I feel as if I've solved the mystery. None of all conspiracy theories, because I would say that some conspiracy theories are true. You know, it's not like I'm not one of these kind of, arch sort of super skeptics who doesn't believe in any of this stuff. You know, I believe that there's certainly more to the Oklahoma bomb than meets the eye, for instance. But I think my days of writing about conspiracy theories and theorists are over. But
okay.
I still think, you know, the human brain is such a wonderful, mysterious thing, and the crazy ways that people behave is so wonderful and mysterious. I think I've got a lifetime of investigating left to do.
All right. John Ronson, thanks very much. We're out of time. John Ronson, his book is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. He joined us from his home in London. Radio West is a production of KUWR News. The program was directed today by Michael Havey, produced by Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Our senior producer is Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.